This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast,
where this week we are on episode 68, where we are covering the Amityville house.
We're getting spooky with it.
Yeah, we gotta get a little spooky for Halloween.
Exactly, and we thought that this was perfect because it covers murder and some paranormal stuff.
Yeah, and we don't, like, have we really done a lot of paranormal stuff on here before? Only, like, last Halloween, right? Yeah,
and we did an exorcism that time.
That's true, but it could also be just
her child abuse.
Yeah, that one was unclear.
Like, it wasn't paranormally,
Yeah, so this is going to be, like, our first paranormally one, which we're both interested in.
Yeah.
You know, we both like the paranormal stuff. We both think it's fun, but
We
chose a true crime podcast, so, you know, we don't get to talk about it that often.
Exactly.
But before we get into our spookier episode today, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So, this week I am binging another Netflix show.
Yeah.
Because apparently all I watch is Netflix.
That's
even
fine.
Though I have your Hulu password. But it is called Dead to Me.
Yeah.
And okay. I'm in fucking love with it. Like,
nice.
I don't know what it is, but I'm just, like, obsessed with it. I have binged the first season.
Yeah.
Within a couple days. There are two seasons out right now. I just started the second. But essentially, it's about these two women. One who is played by Christina Applegate.
Mm-hmm.
Great actress.
Yeah.
And she's, like, a hard-ass mom. And the other one is, her name is Judy in the show. She's played by Linda Cardellini, I think is how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
Also great actor. Also James Marsden, isn't it?
Marsden, yeah.
But Judy is like a softer woman, and they meet in a support group for grieving loss. And they, like, weirdly become best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, it's really hard to give a lot of detail about it without giving spoilers.
Yeah, I've seen the, like, trailer for it, so I know, but I'm also not gonna, like...
Yeah, and, like, so they give... Basically, the biggest spoiler happens at the end of the first episode, but essentially, Jen's husband had been killed, and these two women become best friends, and Judy has a secret... And she knows who killed Jen's husband. And that is as far as I'm going to take it. But it's really good. The acting is great. And it involves, like, murder and trying to figure out who killed him. And also drama and also, like, friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but, like, whenever I watch this particular show... Whatever, like, emotion or feeling is happening in that show, I, like, start to feel it. And that doesn't happen with other shows,
yeah.
So it's just weird. It just, like, it's captivating me for some reason.
Good.
But I'm really liking it, and I'm ready to watch the second season.
Very nice. Yeah, I haven't watched that, but it's come up, like, in the suggested a lot.
Yeah, it's, like... It's a little more dramatic than murder, kind of, but it's still a good show. I think you'd like it.
All right. I'll have to give it a try sometime. There's, like, far too many shows to watch, so I'm saying that, but I'm actually not committing to that at all because
I understand.
I don't know if I'll ever get there.
What is your binge this week, Morgan?
My binge is going to be specifically... this era of Miley Cyrus.
Yes, I get it.
I have just been, like, I mean, Jolene, her, like, backyard sessions of Jolene forever ago has, like, always been my jam. I was like, Miley has a great voice. She's questionable taste and things like that for, like, a lot of people. But I always, like, loved that style of her voice. Like, it works really well for her. And she's just, like... going and doing her thing right now and doing her, like, raspy voice singing that's, like, draws very heavily on Dolly Parton. And I'm into it.
It's really good.
I don't, like, super love the mullet, but apparently the internet loves it, so I'm sorry for the unpopular opinion, But she can rock it. I just don't think anyone should rock a mullet. I think that is a hairstyle we should have left in the past.
But it is coming back.
It is coming back in a big way.
But it's really weird because it's coming back, like, very redneck style, but also hipsters.
Yeah.
And they're, I'm like, I don't know where you stand in your life, my
guy. It's really hard to tell in Florida who's a redneck or a hipster.
Yes.
But yeah, she just, like, she did a cover of Heart of Glass by Blondie, and she did, like, the Zombies Cranberries, the Cranberries Zombie. And yeah, she's just doing really well. And her new song that she's, like, done on all of these different platforms promoting, I think it's called Midnight Sky, is very good as well. It, like, definitely has more of the raspy voice. So I'm just digging it. I listen to her covers just, like, periodically throughout the day because they're fun. I like them.
Yeah, like, when I would, I mean, I grew up watching Hannah Montana.
Oh, yeah, me too. I was far too old for it when it ended, and I was like, I'm seeing Hannah Montana in theaters, bitches. I don't care.
Exactly. And, like, I always liked her music. She had kind of a downfall with some of her, like, going into rap songs I wasn't a fan of. But, like you said, she has a great fucking voice. Yeah. And I think what she's been doing lately in these, like, rock covers, and she's going to be covering Metallica's music. Like, I think that's what her voice is meant for.
Yeah, her voice definitely leans more towards that instead of, like, the pop that she's been doing for most of her life, you know, because that was probably the easiest thing to get into.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've just been digging Miley again. So, you know, that's where I'm at.
Also,
yeah,
tomorrow's Halloween.
Oh, yeah. I forgot because we're recording this before then. Yeah. But happy almost Halloween, friends.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that you should tell the podcast your idea of what you want to be.
Oh, God.
Because it's so good.
So this is a stolen idea. I will say that. But for Halloween this year, I am going to be Lisa Frank Castle. So
I love it.
I will be wearing some Lisa Frank style clothing with the Punisher symbol on the front and some boots and things like that. Hopefully I can pull it off. But when I saw it, I was like, that is so fucking clever. I'm stealing your clever ass idea. So yeah. Like everything in my life, it's from Critical Role. But also, Marisha did it, and her and I share a birthday, so I feel like, realistically, we're just friends, and I'm allowed to.
Yeah, you're spiritually connected to her.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, for sure. And it's Sarah's birthday, so she doesn't know what she's going to be yet, but I think she should dress up.
I'm trying to do, like, a 90s couples costume, trying to convince my fiancé. It's hard. So I'm thinking either, like, TJ and Spinelli from Recess, or, like, Cat Dog, or even, like, Steve and Blue from Blue's Clues.
Yeah.
Something like that. I know in the past, Morgan has been, like, a champ at costumes, and I just, like, I feel like I need to get to her level, because I'm always just, like, generic party store costumes.
I just really enjoy making my own costume, you know? Because I don't know. There's just something about it that makes it more fun.
Yeah.
And I've recently, like, really been wanting to learn how to sew so I can, like, actually cosplay when all of this pandemic shit is over, you know?
Yeah.
Because
it'd be fun.
Before, I was too scared to, like, do things like go to cons. And now I'm like, I should live my life and go to a fucking con because that sounds dope.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
R.I.P. Crime Con.
Yeah, R.I.P. Crime Con. And all cons, really, that were supposed to happen this year. And
very true.
Potentially next year. When the internal dread sets in. Also, while we're here, we haven't really made any mention of it, because I literally forget every episode. But if you have not already made your plan to vote, go fucking vote.
Yeah, you only have a few days to early vote, or
really vote at all, because November 3rd is your last day to vote. So that is like 4 or 5 days from the release of this episode. So go fucking cast your vote, because it is highly important to do so.
It is. I have my absentee ballot. I have it halfway filled out. I have a few more things that I have to do research on.
Yeah.
And then I think I'm going to drop it off at one of those early voting locations where they have the drop box.
Yeah.
It's just as easy as that, on my way to the grocery store.
That is what I'm doing, but I'm also going to wear a cute outfit and make it a way...
Instagram worthy?
I mean, like, I take a lot of photos and haven't posted anything on Instagram in over 2 years. So I might take a photo, but it probably won't actually see Instagram. But, you know, you don't get, like, opportunities to dress up anymore in COVID America. So I'm going to fucking dress up to drop my ballot off.
Do it.
Just,
have you seen that picture of Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds?
No.
She's like, this is the only thing I've dressed up for is dropping off my ballot.
Yeah. So I feel like it's a great time.
Yeah.
Just make it an event for yourself, you know?
Go fucking get some lunch afterwards.
Well,
and make
I mean,
it a day.
It's the middle of a Tuesday, so.
Well, I mean, if you can early vote on the weekends.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of, just try and do it if you can. Not try.
Do it.
Do it. I was talking about trying to do the lunch thing specifically, because I will not be doing that. But just do something for yourself that makes voting special, because you should vote and have your voice heard. And if you think your voice isn't being heard, then you are not actually listening. All right. Now that I've lectured you, let's get started with today's episode.
Let's do it.
All right.
So, the DeFeo family consisted of Ronald DeFeo Sr. and Louise DeFeo, as well as their 5 children, Ronald Jr., Don, Allison, Mark, and John. The family lived in Brooklyn, New York, where Ronald Sr. worked as a car salesman at his father-in-law's Buick dealership, and he was very good at his job, and he did very well for himself and the family. But now, we're basically just going to focus on Ronald Jr. So, Ronald Joseph Butch DeFeo Jr. was born on September 26, 1951 in Brooklyn, New York. And from now on, since his name is Ronald and his dad's name is Ronald, we're going to call him Butch because that's what everyone else called him. So, Butch was the oldest of the 5 children. And in 1965... Ronald Sr. bought a house in Amityville, New York, located at 112 Ocean Avenue. So the family moved from Brooklyn to, that's more like the Long Island area. This house was located on the Amityville River, had 2 stories and an attic, enough room for Ronald Sr., Louise, and their 5 kids, and it even had a boathouse. Ronald Sr. was also very controlling. And he had a bad temper. He would get into bad fights with his wife and children, and Butch eventually started taking the brunt of Ronald Sr.'s anger. And as a child, Butch was also bullied heavily in school for being overweight, which his father, you know, told him to stand up for, but if he ever stand up for being bullied at home, he wouldn't take any of that, you know? Butch went through school without many friends, and he mainly kept to himself. As Butch matured, he no longer accepted the bullying brought down on him by his father, and screaming matches between the two would frequently turn into fist fights.
Ronald and Louise realized that Butch's temper, which grew even worse than his father, was not normal and took him to see a psychiatrist. Butch constantly denied that he needed any help and would just not talk when he was in session with the therapist, with the psychiatrist. Since the psychiatrist didn't work, Ronald and Louise thought of another strategy to keep Butch in line, and that was basically to just buy and give Butch whatever he wanted to keep him happy and satisfied.
So basically just to, like, bribe him.
Yeah. His parents ended up buying him a car and a $14,000 speedboat, which in 2020 would be over a $90,000 boat.
So that's a fancy-ass boat.
Mm-hmm. They would also give him cash whenever he asked, and if Butch didn't feel like asking, he would just take it. By the time he was 17, Butch was kicked out of school. He still had anger problems and began using serious drugs such as LSD and heroin. He also wasn't just lashing out at his family, but also his friends. One time, he went on a hunting trip with some friends and pointed a loaded rifle at one of them. His friend ran away, and when Butch caught up with him later that afternoon, he pretended that nothing had happened and asked why he had left so early. When he was 18, Butch was given a job at the car dealership that his grandfather owned. He said it was an easy job and not much was expected out of him, and even if he didn't show up to work, his father would still pay him at the end of the week, so it was a pretty sweet gig. He would use this money to buy stuff for his car, alcohol, guns, and drugs. Even with all of this, Butch's temper never decreased, and he still got into fights with his father. One evening, Ronald Sr. and Louise got into a fight, and Butch did not like this. And Butch did not like his father yelling at his mother, so he went into his room, grabbed a 12-gauge shotgun, loaded it with one shell, and went downstairs. He pointed the shotgun at his father's face and yelled, "Leave that woman alone. I'm going to kill you, you fat fuck. This is it." He then pulled the trigger, but the gun jammed and didn't go off. Ronald just stood there and didn't move as Butch lowered the gun and casually walked out of the room like nothing ever happened.
That is lucky.
Yeah, that is really lucky.
So Butch eventually becomes not happy with the amount of money that he's getting every week while working at the car dealership, so he comes up with this plan to rob it. He made this plan up with a friend of his and agreed to split the money. Butch was given the task of taking money to the bank to deposit it, and this was $1,800 worth of cash and $20,000 worth of checks. When Butch returned to the car dealership, 2 hours later, he told his father that he had been robbed of the money at gunpoint while he was waiting at a red light. And now, Ronald Sr. was pissed about the situation, but also about the fact that someone gave Butch the job of taking the deposit to the bank, as he didn't trust Butch with just random money like that.
Yeah, and like, realistically, someone should have gone to the bank with him. Mm-hmm. Like, any two people should be going to the bank regardless.
When the police are called, they obviously wanted to talk to Butch. Instead of cooperating with the police, he's tense. When the police suspect that Butch is lying and ask him why he was gone for 2 hours after he was robbed and didn't rush back to the dealership, Butch just becomes outright angry and violent, cursing at the police and beating on the cars with his fists. A few days later, the police ask him to go down to the police station and look at some mugshots and potentially identify who robbed him. Butch initially agreed to this, but backed out at the last minute. When Ronald heard about this, he confronted Butch at work, asking him why he wouldn't cooperate with the police. And this obviously resulted in a screaming match between the two, where Ronald said, "You've got the devil on your back." And Butch replied by yelling, "You fat prick, I'll kill you." And then he ran to his car and drove off. Now, Butch was the only person in the house with his own room, which he acquired by his parents trying to please him and give him everything he wanted. So his parents shared a room, his two younger brothers shared a room, and his two sisters shared a room.
Wouldn't his parents share a room
anyways,
regardless? Yeah. Okay. did he, like, take the master bedroom or something?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Because that's not that weird, like, in terms of the parents. But, like, at the kids, it's, like, kind of annoying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In the early morning hours of Wednesday, November 14th, 1974... just 5 days after the last fight with his father, 23-year-old Butch sat in his room by himself while the rest of his family was asleep. He went into the closet and pulled out a .35 caliber Marlin rifle. He walked to his parents' bedroom and opened the door, standing there for a minute, watching them sleep. He then raised the rifle, placed it to his shoulder, pointed it at his father's sleeping body, and pulled the trigger. This shot entered into Ronald's back, tore through his kidney, and exited through his chest. He shot again at his father. The second bullet pierced the base of Ronald's spine and got lodged in his neck. His mom, Louise, wakes up from the shots but didn't have any time to react before Butch put two bullets into her as well. The bullets shattered her ribcage and collapsed her right lung. Ronald Sr. was 44 and Louise was 42. With the sound of the gun going off four times, Butch heard no one moving around in the house. Next, he made his way into the bedroom of his two younger brothers, Mark, who was 12, and John, who was 9. He stood in between the beds of his two brothers and shot them both one time. Mark laid still, but John's spinal cord had been severed by the bullet, which caused his body to spasm for a few moments before his death. Lastly, Butch made his way to his sister's room. When he walked in, his younger sister, Allison, who was 13, woke up and looked up at him. He immediately pointed the gun at her and pulled the trigger. She was killed instantly. His eldest sister, Dawn, who was 18 years old, was his last victim of the night. He aimed the gun at Dawn's head and pulled the trigger, literally blowing off the left side of her face.
So everything was, like, brutal.
Mm-hmm.
So the time was just after 3 a.m., and within the span of 15 minutes, Butch had murdered all six members of his family. The family's dog, Shaggy, was locked away in the boathouse, but was insanely barking from the sounds of the guns going off, but none of the neighbors stirred. Butch decided that he now needed to clean himself up and create an alibi. So he took a shower, trimmed his beard, and got dressed in jeans and work boots. He then took his bloody clothes and the rifle, wrapped them up in a pillowcase, and got in his car. He drove from Amityville to Brooklyn and disposed of the pillowcase down a storm drain to get rid of it. He then made his way back to Long Island and went to work at his grandfather's Buick dealership at around 6 a.m. And this is when he begins his big act of reaching out to his parents. While at work, he tried calling the family home a couple of times, telling coworkers that it was weird that his dad wasn't at work and that his family wasn't answering the phone, but you know, he didn't seem too worried. He acted as though there was nothing for him to do at work and left early at around noon. After leaving work, he called his girlfriend, 19-year-old Sherry Klein, and told her that he got off work early and wanted to see her. He stopped at Sherry's house and told her he had tried to call his parents a few times, but they didn't answer. He said that it was strange because all of the cars were in the driveway, but still no answer. He even tried calling the house while at Sherry's to show her. Sherry seemed kind of worried at the time, but the two basically brushed it off and spent the afternoon shopping together at the mall. After the mall, the couple stopped at Butch's friend Bobby's house. He told Bobby the same thing about his family not picking up the phone and again tried calling the house from Bobby's phone. He also told Bobby that the doors to the house were locked and he couldn't get inside. Butch then changed the subject and asked Bobby if he wanted to go out later that night, and the two agreed to meet at a local bar called Henry's at around 6 p.m. After leaving Bobby's house, Butch spent the rest of the afternoon drinking, visiting friends, and doing heroin.
Butch arrived to Henry's bar around 6 p.m., and his friend Bobby showed up shortly after. At the bar, Butch kept talking about not being able to reach his family, and eventually says to his friend, "I'm going to have to go home and break a window to get in," to which Bobby replied, "Well, do what you have to." So Butch left the bar and is only gone for a few minutes when he storms back in. The bar was only a couple of blocks from the DeFeo house, so this isn't super weird. He finds Bobby and says, "Bob, you gotta help me. Someone shot my mother and father." So Butch, Bobby, and a couple of other people at the bar that overheard the commotion all get into Butch's car and drive to the house. Bobby entered the house first, running up the stairs, finding the bodies of Ronald Sr. and Luis. One of the other bar patrons, Joey Yeswit, went inside the house as well. He found the phone and called the police. The first policeman, Officer Kenneth Gaguski, arrived on the scene within 10 minutes. He arrived to find a group of men gathered on the front lawn of the DeFeo household, with Butch in the center of them, acting grief-stricken and sobbing uncontrollably. When the officer walked up to the group, Butch shouted, "My father and mother are dead!" When the police officer went inside, Butch did as well and sat at the kitchen table. The officer then discovered the bodies of Ronald and Louise, as well as Mark and John. He went downstairs to the kitchen and was reporting the findings back to headquarters when Butch informed him that he also had two sisters. Officer Gaguski, as well as another officer who had arrived, Edwin Tyndall, went upstairs and discovered the bodies of Dawn and Allison. It took a forensic investigator to even find out where the girls had been shot, as there was so much blood.
When the police began to question Butch, they asked him who he believed could have murdered his family. Butch replied that it might have been Louis Fellini, who was a known mobster hitman. Butch informed the police that this man held a grudge against the family after an argument occurred when Louis had been staying with the family a few years prior. With police thinking that this could have been a mafia-related incident, they believed that Butch could have been in danger still and continued the questioning at the police station. Butch gave the police a written statement recounting his day. He said that he stayed up watching a movie until 2 a.m. He claimed that he woke up at 4 and heard the toilet flush in the bathroom. Shortly after, when he couldn't fall back asleep, he said he went into work early and then gave the account of the rest of his day that we know, saying he hung out with his girlfriend, went to the bar, and then discovered his parents' bodies. But Butch's story eventually started to crumble. Investigators discovered that it was a .35 caliber rifle that was the gun used to kill all of the family members, and they found empty boxes of ammunition for that type of gun in Butch's room. They also determined that the killing was done sometime in the middle of the night when Butch was still home. Detective Dennis Rafferty was questioning him and said, "Butch, it's incredible. It's almost unbelievable. Butch, we know we have a .35 caliber gun box from your room. Every one of the victims have been shot with a .35 caliber, and you've seen the whole thing. There has to be more than that. It's your gun that was used." So this is when Butch started to change his story. He said that he was, in fact, home when the murders took place, and that he had been awoken by Louis Fellini and another man holding a revolver to his head. Then Louis forced him to watch each of his family members be murdered, and then he was forced to get rid of the evidence. The police obviously didn't believe this news story, and as they kept questioning him, Butch kept changing details about the story and basically digging himself into a bigger hole. Eventually, Rafferty asked him, "It didn't happen that way, did it?" Butch then put his head in his hands and said, "Give me a minute." Rafferty responded by saying, "Butch, they were never there, were they? Fellini and the other guy were never there." And Butch finally confessed, saying, "No, it all started so fast. Once I started, I just couldn't stop. It went so fast."
The trial started October 14th, 1975. Butch was pleading not guilty by reason of insanity. The prosecution got a psychiatrist and said that even though he was a user of heroin and LSD and had antisocial personality disorder, that he was aware of what he was doing when killing his family. And I would argue that he already tried to kill his family several times before, so...
Exactly.
While Butch was questioned on the stand, he stated that he heard voices that his family was plotting to kill him. He testified, "As far as I'm concerned, if I didn't kill my family, they were going to kill me. As far as I'm concerned, what I did was self-defense, and there was nothing wrong with it. When I got a gun in my hand, there's no doubt in my mind who I am. I am God." The jury's first vote came back as 10-2, where two jurors were still unsure of Butch's mental state at the time of the killings. But after reviewing the transcripts of the trial, they eventually came back with a 12-0 unanimous vote, and on November 21st, 1975, Butch was charged with 6 counts of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 6 concurrent sentences of 25 years to life. Butch is currently being held at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, New York, and all of his appeals and requests to the parole board have been denied so far. And he is currently 69 years old. And there are also, like, a ton of controversies to this case, as Butch has changed his story many times. And he says that his sister Dawn actually killed the family and that he killed Dawn. And also, many people question the fact that none of the siblings or neighbors heard the gunshots. And one thing we didn't mention earlier was, like, all of the people were sleeping face down in their beds, which is weird to hear, like, gunshots go off and not wake up and just still be laying, like, face down in your bed to be shot. So there's also theories that people did help him kill his family, like multiple people were there to do it at once. Some people even think there's spooky reasons why they never woke up, but
and there's, like, he said sometime that he drugged his family, and people have been like, well, what about a silencer? But there was never a silencer. And also, it's very unlikely that 6 people all sleep on their stomach at the same time, like, it's not a very common sleeping thing. So there's just a ton of stuff with this case that, like, I don't think there's ever going to be a clear answer. And also, like, at one point Butch was like, I was possessed and that's why I did it.
There's a ton of different ways to explain what happened. Basically,
so now we start the spookies. So we're going to talk now about the Lutz family. On December 18th, 1975, 13 months after this brutal crime, the home was sold at a drastically reduced price of $80,000 to the Lutz family. And that'd be around $387,000 today.
Which is probably still low for the area, I would assume.
Oh, yeah, because that's, like, standard around here for a one-story, not even a two-story on the river, you know? So, George and Kathy Lutz were part of a blended family and had recently gotten married earlier that year on July 4th. Both of them had been married before, and their 3 children, which were 2 sons and a daughter, were from Kathy's previous marriage. The family was told before they made the purchase about what happened in the home, and they made the decision to continue with the purchase, feeling that they could get past this tragic past. Before moving in, the couple had the home blessed by a Catholic priest, which I feel like, good move on them, you know.
Because also something I forgot to write down that I'm just remembering is that they moved in with, like, all of the same furniture, which is a good way to get haunted.
Yeah, 100%.
Not the beds weren't there, like, the mattresses, you know, but.
So, the priest said that when he was blessing the sewing room, which I've heard that the Lutzes were going to make it the kids' playroom, he got a really cold presence. And he heard a loud and clear voice say, "Get out." He knew it was December, but this cold, you know, felt different and unnatural. It wasn't like a regular outside snowy cold.
Like a bone-chilling cold.
When he left, he told them that about this strangeness that he felt in the room and suggested that they just didn't use it as a room to sleep in. After less than 4 weeks of living there, 28 days to be exact, on January 14th, the family fled to Kathy's mother's home and never returned back to the house.
So, what happened?
What happened, Morgan? Tell us.
According to the family, they started to experience paranormal activity almost immediately. There were cold spots randomly throughout the house, and jolting sounds would wake them during the night. The family also experienced some personality changes. George started being very controlling with the children, and his temper increased, which was out of character for him. He also secluded himself from the family and would obsess over the fireplace, saying that it would never warm him. Even though the family would cover him in blankets, and even if the house was warm, George was always apparently freezing. He, like, felt that bone-chilling cold all the time as well.
Yeah, and they would say, like, even if they had the furnace going and it was 100 degrees in the house, he could never get warm.
Yeah. George also said he would wake up every morning at 3:15, which was around the time that the murders were carried out. He said that he would wake up to loud sounds, sometimes being the sounds of gunshots, screaming, or doors slamming. When he woke up, he would also no longer be in his bed, but in the basement or another room, or even outside sometimes. One time, also, that's just in general the witching hour, so
exactly.
It could just be spooky things in general. One time, one of the sons, who was 10, went upstairs to put a box in the sewing room. The one that the priest was like, nah, fam.
Mm-hmm.
And he said when he got to the room, there were hundreds of flies in the room. This occurred multiple times, but when other members of the family would go upstairs to check out the room, all of the flies would magically be gone.
Yeah, and if they, like, said that they even killed some of the flies, their dead bodies would be gone.
Yeah.
And all that.
Gross.
Yeah. Flies are, like, aren't they, like, a classic sign of the devil? I think that's what, like, Beelzebub
I think
is known so, for.
Because he stinks like shit. No, I'm just kidding.
Ha.
I think so, though. I'm not entirely certain.
So, on more than one occasion, Kathy felt like she was being touched by an unseen person. And one time claims that after waking from a deep sleep, her face was that of an old hag and it took hours to dissipate. And that she looked like she was like 90 years old.
Yeah, that is foul.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. Kathy also had dreams where she would be able to see through Butch DeFeo's eyes. And like she could see all of his family being murdered through him. And she was even able to give details that, like, the media didn't know. The children also began to argue more than usual. And basically everyone in the house just started to get more and more angry.
Yeah.
The youngest child, Missy, said that she talked to an angel in the room. And I also heard this referred to as just, like, an imaginary friend, something like that. The angel's name was Jody and presented itself as a large pig and could change shape as at will.
Yeah.
George and the eldest son actually saw this pig-shaped figure when they were outside trying to close the garage door that would regularly open on its own. They described it as looking cartoon-like with big wolf-like teeth and bright red eyes. When the older brother ran upstairs to check it out, there was no one in the room, but the rocking chair that was in there was just rocking back and forth on its own. And at one point, this angel convinced Missy to climb through her window onto the roof of the house and told her, "You could be my friend forever if you just jump."
That sounds like the Haunting of Hill House shit.
Yeah, that's creepy as fuck. George and Kathy said that they also saw two large red eyes peering in at them from from the upstairs bedroom window, like it was outside looking in at them.
Yeah, just like floating at the upstairs window.
And the classic green slime oozed from the walls, and a foul stench could be smelled around the home. And they said that there was this cross on the wall that would turn itself upside down, like by itself, and the odor was coming from the cross. To try and get rid of the stench, obviously the family would try and open up the windows. And one time the oldest son opened up one of the windows, and the window came crashing back down, slamming onto his hands, crushing his hands. Like, all of his bone was just destroyed. And then the window magically opened back up on its own. The son's hands were then, again, magically back to normal after they saw a spirit walk past his hands.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it was like, there's some shit. Like, even reconstruction of crushed bones, you know?
Yeah. The family also found themselves not wanting to leave the house, instead inviting people over if they wanted to see them. They were just, like, becoming homebodies. And they actually really were just mostly doing this to see if other people could hear noises going on.
That's what I would do. Subject my friends to my hauntings.
And they said that, like, they had friends come over who would hear the, like, constant footsteps in the hallway upstairs, and then they would go check on the kids, and the kids would be asleep, but, like, the footsteps had been going, that kind of stuff. The family's dog also started acting strange and even tried to hang itself when it was tied up once. For years afterwards, the oldest son had constant dreams where he would either see the dog trying to kill himself, or he would be the dog and try to kill himself as the dog. On the night that finally drove them out of the house, George says that he was lying in bed while everyone was asleep when Kathy's body starts to lift up off of the bed and then starts to slide away from it. He then felt something get in bed with him, and he was immediately unable to move. While this was happening, the kids' beds could be heard continuing to slam up and down and into one another, even though the beds were permanently fixed to the floor. The lights flickered on and off throughout the night, and at one point, they brought the dog to stay up by the bedroom to, like, just kind of make them feel safer, I'm sure. And they tied him to the doorknob, where he spent the rest of the evening just, like, walking in circles and throwing up. In the morning, the boys came down terrified. The night before, they were unable to get downstairs to get to their parents, and vice versa, like, George wasn't able to get up the stairs to get to the kids. And Kathy also had no memory of the night before at all. They got a hold of Father Ray, the priest who originally blessed the house, and asked him to come back. The priest said no and was like, please just leave that house. So the following afternoon, the family fled the home that terrorized them for a month. They didn't pack up their belongings. They just left and never returned to the house. They then moved to San Diego to be as far away from the house as possible.
Yeah, from, like, upstate New York to down south California.
Yeah.
Like, they're, like, other side of the country. And also, there was, like, other little things that would happen all the time. We obviously couldn't put everything in. But, like, all this stuff happened within 28 days.
Yeah. Well, sure. Sure. I don't fully believe if that it all happened. Yeah.
The family didn't immediately tell their story to many people, but were introduced to Jay Anson, a professional writer who had published a number of books in the 1970s. They didn't work directly with him, but they did submit about 45 hours of tape-recorded recollections of the events that they used as a basis for his book, The Amityville Horror. A lot of people don't believe that these tapes exist, as they've never been released, and who fucking knows. The Exorcist had also recently been released, so the novel gained popularity as the country was fascinated by hauntings. And this novel has gained a lot of flack around its accuracy, as there are some inconsistencies found throughout the novel. The Lutzes themselves had said that some of the things are untrue, but this is simply due to Anson's creative liberties being taken. As one can imagine, the Lutzes were also called liars for this story, mainly thinking it was just a get-rich-quick scheme. Daniel, who was one of their sons, claims that this isn't true. His family was pretty financially stable before the haunting happened, but afterwards, they struggled with finances for the rest of their lives. And, like, they earned some money from the royalties, but it faded pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think, like, they got $300,000 and, like, Anson got millions based on all the royalties.
And, like, there's this one thing that, like, they definitely got from the house when it was being investigated.
Yeah.
And it is this one photo that's pretty famous about the house. Like, if you just Google Amityville ghost picture, you'll see it, but we'll post it. And when they took this picture, there's no children in the house, only the paranormal investigators, and they're all adults. And in the photo, you clearly see a boy looking over the banister of the stairs. And this boy looks, like, pretty similar to one of the DeFeo children that were murdered. It looks like John Matthew DeFeo.
Mm-hmm.
And it is creepy. Like, I've seen it multiple times while researching.
Yeah.
And wow. No thanks. Yeah,
that's, like, the only ghost pic I've ever seen that I was like, I feel like that could be a real ghost pic. Yeah. You know?
And it's like, who knows if, you know, all of this stuff happened. There was definitely some stuff going on.
I 100% do not think most of it happened. I think that they definitely were haunted, like, scarily enough to make them leave after 28 days. But I don't think a cartoon pig happened. I don't think the green slime happened, like, oozing from their walls and things, because, like, the time period that it came from, like, that kind of horror was just becoming, like, exciting and well-known. So I feel like that was more of, like, Jay Anson kind of putting in his own things to the story. And then, like, the couple themselves wanting to, like, make their story sound scarier because they were in it for so long, you know? But who knows? Maybe it's all true. It could be. But there's a lot of it that I'm like, I feel like that didn't happen.
Yeah. Like, there's definitely, like, your beds could have levitated and, you know, you could have heard things and felt cold spots. And there was even one story where one of the sons was, like, thrown up the stairs. Like, that stuff could have 100% happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like things like turning 90 years old and the slime and the flies magically disappearing and the hands being reconstructed magically.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot to believe without, you know, actual proof.
Yeah, especially for it to happen so much so soon, and then everyone who's owned the house afterwards has experienced nothing.
Yeah.
However, the family does say that they think that the spirits from that house did follow them for the rest of their lives. Like, they felt that they were haunted the rest of their lives. So maybe that's a reason why. But I feel like that house has more of a reason to be haunted than most.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, you know, unless it's, like, a true demonic presence that attaches to people, I feel like most, like, spirits and hauntings stay with the house. Like, the children were murdered in the house. They're not going to go with you when you leave.
Yeah. So there is a theory that the presence was already in the house, and that is why Butch murdered his family. And that's why all of the family members were, like, face down in their beds. So there's a lot of shit with this story. You could literally talk about 87 million different theories because there's it's one of those stories that's been told and retold so many times that it's hard to know what's true. But the Lutzes, till the day they died, said that they were haunted in that home.
Yeah.
So I believe them.
Yeah, I don't doubt it.
Yeah, I think that Jay Anson took creative license because most authors do. You know?
And he was like, you know what would make this so good?
Yeah.
Let's get some green ectoplasm.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like a ton of different people we also could have talked about. there's a supposed lawyer that helped them come up with the story, but you know, we only had one episode.
Yeah.
So we aren't last podcast. We're not doing a multi-parter on Amityville. When I saw that they had done a, because I knew they covered it like a while ago. And when I saw those two parts, I was shocked. I was like, wow, you guys really put a lot of effort into this. Look at you go. I didn't listen.
I did. And I feel like as much as I love last podcast, yeah, I feel like a lot of it is more them talking rather than the research. So I feel like if they did more like we do and mm-hmm. don't have as much discussion in between, it could have 100% been one episode.
Yeah, I think that's also their earlier episodes because mm-hmm. they literally have a team of researchers who works for them now. So yeah, I don't doubt they put in a lot of research.
Yeah, it was like in the early 100s, yeah, and they're like in the fucking thousands. Yeah. No, they're in like 500s now. But
yeah, so that's probably why.
Mm-hmm. But we do our own research.
Yeah. but we hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and that you got a little spooked out for the Halloween season.
Yes, and we hope you have a happy Halloween tomorrow.
Yes, be safe in whatever you do or don't, because there is still technically a global pandemic going on.
Right.
So we hope that you guys liked it. If you did, make sure you go and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
And check us out on social media. We are at Crime Binge on Twitter and Crime Binge Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And make sure you definitely check out that photo we'll be posting on both Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, make sure to check it out because it is a very creepy one.
It is spooktacular.
All right, guys. And keep on binging. Bye.
Happy Halloween.